From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, life in a refugee camp along the Syrian-Turkey border.
Everyone has a horror story. Of course, the difficult trek into Turkey and now the difficult conditions they live in.
Muslims feel violent backlash after Australian anti-terror raids. Tensions flare again in Hong Kong. And Taiwan targets food safety after a rash of scandals. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Kurdish forces are in a second month of defending the northern Syrian city of Kobani from Islamic State militants. A U.S.-led coalition is also working to push back the ultra-radical group. VOA correspondent Scott Bobb is on the Syria-Turkey border outside Kobani. Today he visited a local refugee camp.
The conditions are relatively good, and no camp is very pleasant, especially with winter coming on. These are tarpaulin tents that people are living in mostly. There have been distributions of clothes, blankets. The refugees say they are getting three meals a day. There's sanitation, some. There's some water. But, of course, it's not enough, and they miss home. There are worries with the cold weather coming in. Nights are particularly cold now because of the altitude and the wind. Children are falling sick, and of course, it's just not the same when you're living in a tent. So people acknowledge that they're receiving a great deal of assistance, both from the Turkish government, from some of the political parties, in particular the Kurdish party here, where the Kurds are very predominant, and also from just independent donors and private Turks who are helping out their people. But nevertheless, it's a difficult situation. And for small villages and small towns in this area, they're being overwhelmed. You have a town of 10 to 20,000 people being overwhelmed by tens of thousands of refugees, for example. So it's a difficult situation, but it's certainly better than others I've seen in other countries neighboring Syria.
Speaking with the refugees, how are they doing emotionally?
Difficult. They all have intense feelings against the Islamic State. They all, each and every one, talk about how the fighters came in and they executed people, accusing these Kurds who are Muslims of being Jews and therefore infidels, and taking all their belongings and their money and then executing some of them. Everyone has a horror story. Of course, the difficult trek into Turkey and now the difficult conditions they live in is what they mostly talk about.
What about the future? Any hopes?
Well, it's interesting. These people who have arrived only days ago, this one camp I visited has only been open for 20 days now. They talk about going back within days, within a month at the most. They believe that if the Western powers that are currently assisting or staging air attacks against Islamic State positions, if they continue, and they, by the way, are very thankful for those, then they could be home in a month's time. Many of the veterans who have been watching this war for several years don't feel that that's quite likely. But nevertheless, that's the hope for these people.
VOA correspondent Scott Bobb speaking with us from the Syria-Turkey border outside Kobani. Jordan is among the Arab countries that joined the international coalition against ISIL. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said that the backing of Sunni-dominated nations such as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Turkey will lend support to any campaign to contain the spread of the Islamic State militants. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy discussed the threats ISIL poses to Jordan and what could Jordan offer the coalition with Besma Momani, Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Waterloo.
Professor Besma, Jordan is located in the Levant region, bordering both Syria and Iraq. Would that make it the jewel of ISIL's plan?
Well, in some respects, yes, but I don't think ISIL has its sights on Jordan yet. It's more interested in trying to consolidate the land that it has and the territory it has, straddling both Syria and Iraq. It simply doesn't have the fighting force at the moment to try and take on another country or another military. It really thrives on countries where there is a political vacuum or state of anarchy, which is exactly what we're seeing in both the case of Syria and perhaps to a lesser extent in Iraq.
But the so-called Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was quoted to have designated Jordan as the next step for his caliphate. To what extent Jordan is threatened by ISIL?
Well, I think Baghdadi may be threatening Jordan, but I don't think Jordan is under threat, partly because I don't think ISIL has the capability to take on Jordan. Jordan is always trying to balance various domestic interests, and that's always been its greatest challenge. It has a very interesting mix of different interests, rural versus urban. It has a great deal of refugees now, obviously, from Syria, which have very different expectations of Jordan in participating in any sort of coalition against ISIL. And it has, of course, been welcoming to Iraqi refugees in the past. So trying to balance that with general Jordanian local interest and not really being actively involved in sort of the neighborhood and really focusing more on domestic issues of concern, particularly economic ones, means that Jordan really has to balance a variety of different domestic interests.
There are some reports about thousands of Jordanians joining the fight with ISIL and a fear of sleeping cells among the refugees who fled to Jordan. What's Jordan doing to deal with that?
Well, Jordan's always been very much dependent on using its intelligence service. I think it's probably most famous for having a very positive ability to really penetrate much of its domestic community, and always has its eyes and ears working. And it does that with sort of a reputation of not being as crude as much of the neighbors have been in trying to find out potential risks and threats to its domestic population and interests. I think in terms of the sleeping cells, that's always a risk. And obviously many of the refugees who have fled to Jordan are very frustrated with their situation and want as much international action, not just from Jordan, but from the globe, to really fight back primarily the Assad government, who's really responsible for much of these deaths, and secondarily to the rise of this extremist group. So there's always going to be pressure from the refugees. Whether or not there are sleeper cells inside those refugee communities, I think the Jordanians have been effective in being able to keep their eyes and ears on those refugee communities to ensure that that doesn't happen.
In addition to intelligence, what could Jordan offer the international coalition against ISIL?
Well, it really is primarily intelligence. Secondarily, of course, it does have some tribal linkages, particularly in the south, with perhaps some individuals in Anbar or tribes in Anbar. That kind of tribal connection is always useful in creating the kind of popular grassroots support for any assault on ISIL. At the end of the day, you do need to have the hearts and minds on your side, and I think Jordan can always be very useful as a Sunni, predominantly Sunni country that does have a positive relationship with much of its tribes, to be able to try and foster that kind of inclusive dialogue with the fellow Sunni tribes that are in Anbar, for example, and parts of Dara, which again have a lot of affinity to the Jordanian tribes themselves.
Besma Moumani, Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Waterloo. We hope to bring you more of her remarks Monday here on International Edition. Islamic groups are reporting a rise in anti-Muslim attacks in Australia since counter-terror raids in Sydney and Melbourne and threats made by Islamic State. Muslim leaders are compiling a list of racially or religiously motivated assaults and say there have been dozens so far, mainly against women wearing the hijab. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Islamic organisations in Australia say there have been at least 30 attacks on Muslims since counter-terrorism raids in Sydney and Brisbane. Threats made against Australia by the radical Islamic State group have also fuelled the backlash. Mariam Vaisardeh, a lawyer and Islamic community spokesperson who's compiling a list of assaults, says violence has been reported across the country.
In one case, a Western Sydney mother and her baby were spat on and her pram kicked. In another, a man in Perth tried to rip the scarf off a woman's head. Several mosques around the country have been threatened, egged, vandalised, and a pig's head impaled on a cross.
The highest rate of reported acts of assault and acts of intimidation have been in the state of Queensland, where mosques have also been threatened and death threats made against Islamic leaders. Silma Iram from the Australian Muslim Women's Association says intimidation is rife.
I've got two family members who are living in South Australia and they've copped verbal abuse. It seems to be the most common thing that there's more suspicion attached now to particularly women because they're vulnerable and because they wear the hijab. And even children. We haven't had a lot about what's happening to kids in the schoolyard, but that's also an area of concern.
Accurate police statistics on assaults are unavailable, although Australia's largest force in New South Wales says it's actively seeking to ease tensions with the Islamic community since last month's anti-terror raids in Sydney. One small far-right group is campaigning to have Islam banned in Australia. Ralph Serminara, a former soldier and the president of the Australian Defence League, says Muslims have been responsible for a breakdown in law and order in the nation's biggest city, Sydney.
They're coming after us. They're raping our children. They're raping our families. Now in the West, it's pretty much a crime capital of Sydney.
While most of Australia's political leaders have urged restraint and respect for those of different faiths, others have been accused of stoking tensions between Muslims and the broader community. Rights groups have criticised Conservative Senator Corey Bernardi, who's called for a ban on the burqa at the federal parliament in Canberra.
I see no reason why any individual should be allowed to enter the parliamentary building with their identity concealed. It makes no sense. It doesn't pass the pub test or the common sense test. And whether it's a balaclava wearer or someone wearing a niqab or a burqa, I think the principle is exactly the same.
Australian jets have joined US-led airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Iraq and fuelled by concerns about the dangers posed by Australian jihadists returning home from conflict in the Middle East. Canberra recently raised its domestic terror threat level from medium to high. New counter-terrorism laws will also give the authorities greater powers to detain suspects and confiscate passports. Prime Minister Tony Abbott says the laws will not affect law-abiding Muslims. He's also planning new measures to make it a crime to promote terrorism in Australia and has singled out the radical group Hizb ut-Tahrir.
There is no doubt they are an organisation that campaigns against Australian values, that campaigns against Australian interests. They are a thoroughly objectionable organisation.
Moderate Muslims in Australia have publicly condemned Islamic State, but community leaders say the level of anti-Islamic abuse and intimidation is rising, as it did after the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, and following the bombings on the Indonesian vacation island of Bali a year later, in which 88 Australians died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Hours after Hong Kong leader Leung Cheung-yung announced his government is seeking negotiations with democracy protesters, tensions flared again at dawn in the semi-autonomous Chinese city. Hundreds of police officers moved onto the streets of Kwan Lun, removing barricades in an effort to end the occupation of Mong Kok shopping district, the scene of violent confrontations between police, democracy protesters, and pro-Beijing elements in the last 19 days. Ivan Broadhead reports from Hong Kong.
Riot police and cranes on trucks moved into Mong Kok at 5 a.m. Friday, while officers insisted they were removing obstructions on the road and not the protest camp itself. A young activist who wished to remain anonymous said she and her friends were disappointed by the police action.
I started violently, falsely to clear all the tents, and they blocked some of my friends' tents, especially. They didn't need to do that, but they broke it. They're very good to lie to themselves. We are so angry.
Police moved in scarcely 12 hours after Liang Chengying attempted to reopen dialogue with students and other protest groups, just a week after his government unilaterally withdrew from the negotiation process. Hong Kong Federation of Students leader Alex Chow queried Liang's sincerity in offering talks. He said the proposal was inconsistent with police orders to clear the streets and the government's refusal to provide constitutional alternatives to Beijing's decision to vet candidates for elections in 2017, the main catalyst for the three-week occupation.
Hong Kong people and citizens and students, they have provided different possibilities for the government to solve the current problem. But so far, we could not see any concrete proposal proposed by the government. So, well, it really depends on the government if there will be any concrete result, constructive dialogue.
Accusations also continue to fly in relation to the brutal assault on Civic Party activist and social worker Ken Zeng, who, it emerged, flew back to Hong Kong from a nine-month visit to South America expressly to participate in the constitutional protests. Civic Party legislator Ronnie Tong said although he felt Leung's negotiation offer will achieve little politically, it may calm tensions that escalated after footage of the attack on Zeng was broadcast around the world Wednesday.
I think what happened 2 nights ago in fact has helped to raise the temperature of both sides yet again. I can't really say that I expect a lot of progress will come out of the talks, but I think the sooner they sit down and talk about it, the quicker temperature would die down a little bit. So I really hope that they can meet latest on Monday or Tuesday.
Attention now returns to the main Admiralty demonstration site. Pro-establishment parties insist the protests centred here are most harmful to the Hong Kong economy. However, a growing body of analysis cited in Friday's Wall Street Journal suggests the long-term economic effect will be minimal, with tourist numbers and trade figures holding up well. Local corporate governance expert David Webb adds that extended suffrage in Hong Kong should actually help improve prosperity. He says there is no large-scale economy that is prosperous that does not enjoy democracy.
I mean, eventually China is going to be a democracy itself, or it's not going to get to the levels of prosperity that its people desire. And I think most people understand that if you want free markets and the benefits of competition, then you also want that in your leadership. And they almost go hand in hand.
Protester numbers are again swelling in the Central District as the now traditional weekend of rallies and solidarity meetings approaches. Given that a clear strategy has emerged of police breaking down satellite protest camps each night this week, the government now faces the headache of what to do about the thousands of protesters entrenched in this last remaining camp, situated in the heart of the city. Ivan Broadhead for VOA News, Hong Kong.
Taiwan's government says catching companies selling tainted food following the island's third major cooking oil scandal in a year is now a top priority. The flaps over altered cooking oil have scared consumers who had thought Taiwan safe from food scams. Ralph Jennings has details from Taipei.
The premier of Taiwan has ordered government departments to expose what he described as corrupt food manufacturers. This month, the government shut down oil processing at a plant that it says used animal feed oil from Vietnam and called it fit for humans. Officials have authorized emergency imports of lard to offset the tainted products. As public anger rises over the latest cooking oil scandal, the scale of which is unusual for Taiwan's modern society, the premier also vowed to pursue any other manufacturers that are tainting or mislabeling food. Taiwan cabinet spokesman Sun Lichun says manufacturers involved in the scams cheated to make money. He says price competition is a possible key reason for the problem. Sun adds that big companies lacked the sense of responsibility to purchase quality raw materials from upstream suppliers and that they knew about problematic oil ingredients early on. He says this is a matter the public cannot accept. This month, Taiwan prosecutors began probing Greater China food giant Dingxin International Group for sales of cooking oil believed to contain oil for animal feed. Dingxin executive Wei Yingchong apologized to Taiwan Saturday and vowed to take responsibility. Taiwan's government believes a subsidiary of Dingxin and a supplier control 95% of Taiwan's lard market. The company is also China's biggest instant noodle maker. Prosecutors began this month probing another food processor that may have used industrial oils. Lian Yunping, a 37-year-old housewife, has stopped shopping at a bakery in her hometown Hsinchu because that processor supplies it. She says she makes bread at home now for a sense of safety so she can control the source of ingredients and has turned to olive oil. She fears the government is handling the oil scandals in a way that shows too much sensitivity to business interests and economic development and is hard to trust. An earlier food scandal in Taiwan, uncovered in September, involved the widespread use of cooking oil made from kitchen waste and other low-quality ingredients. That discovery, prompted by the complaint of a farmer who collected his own evidence, led to recalls affecting 1,200 restaurants and food processors for losses of $165 million. In October last year, a Taiwanese supplier to Dingxin subsidiary Weitran Food Corporation was found adding a food coloring agent to make cheaper oils look like the more expensive olive and grapeseed oils. The tainted oil supply chain may extend to Hong Kong and the Philippines. Andrew Tsai, economist for KGI Securities in Taipei, says consumer confidence will weaken if the scandals go on, causing losses to the food service sector. Government officials say the tainted oils pose no immediate health risks. But a restaurant association with 100,000-odd members began to boycott Dingxin this week. Some consumers who normally save time or see friends by eating out have turned to cooking at home with vegetable oil. Ralph Dennings, VOA News, Taipei.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
President Obama says a travel ban from West Africa is not the way to fight against Ebola. He told reporters at the White House Thursday that he has no philosophical objection to keeping travelers from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone out of the U.S., but he said experts have told him that such a ban would be less effective than the procedures already in place. The president said travelers would be less likely to be screened and treated, leading to more cases rather than less. Some in Congress have been demanding a travel ban. Louisiana Republican Representative Steve Scalise is one of them. Scalise was part of a congressional panel questioning Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Frieden was asked about his interaction with the White House on a variety of issues related to Ebola, including travel restrictions on people coming from West Africa to the U.S. In this exchange, Dr. Frieden speaks first, then Representative Scalise.
From the CDC's perspective, we will consider anything that will better protect...
So are you going to answer the question about your conversations with the White House? Is the White House considering a travel ban?
I can't speak for the White House.
Do you know if they've ruled out a travel ban?
I can't speak for the White
House. Have you had conversations with them about it?
We've discussed the issue of travel.
All right. I would urge you, at a minimum, if you've ruled out a travel ban, if you don't think it's the right way to go, there are a lot of people that would disagree with you, at a minimum, you ought to look at least immediately suspending visas to non-U.S. nationals seeking to travel into the United States from Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea.
The spread of Ebola to two hospital nurses who cared for a Liberian patient, Thomas Duncan, at a U.S. hospital in Dallas, Texas, and revelations that nurse Amber Vinson traveled on a commercial airliner while running a slight fever have caused Dr. Frieden to backtrack on earlier statements about his confidence in the ability of American health officials to contain the disease. Fears of infection from Vinson's Monday flight from Cleveland, Ohio to Dallas, a day before she was diagnosed with Ebola, led to school closings in Ohio and Texas and caused airline stock prices to fall on Wall Street. When asked by Representative Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania about his confidence in keeping track of those exposed to Ebola, Dr. Frieden has this to say.
Our fundamental mission is to protect Americans. Right now, we're able to track everyone who comes in.
But you're not stopping them from being around other people, doctor. I understand that. I have a high respect for you, but my concern is the American people says, but even so, they're not limited from travel. They're not quarantined for 21 days because they can still show up as symptoms. They can still bypass all the questions that Mr. Wagner referred to in the thermometers on there. So, and this is what happened with the nurse who went to Cleveland. So I'm concerned here. Is this going to be your maintaining position of the administration that there will be no travel restrictions?
We will consider any options to better protect Americans.
Dr. Tom Frieden also conceded that protocols to protect from Ebola transmission need to be revised. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On October 17th, 539 BC, Cyrus the Great marched into the city of Babylon, releasing the Jews from almost 70 years of exile. Cyrus allowed the Jews to rebuild their temple in Jerusalem. In 1888, Thomas Edison filed for a patent for what he called the optical phonograph, which was basically an early movie camera. On this day in 1931, mobster Al Capone was convicted of income tax evasion and sentenced to 11 years in prison. In 1933, Albert Einstein arrived in the United States as a refugee from Nazi Germany. On this day in 1973, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, prohibited nations that had supported Israel in the Yom Kippur War from buying its oil. The ensuing energy crisis marked the end of the era of inexpensive gasoline. In 1979, Mother Teresa was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her work with the poor in Calcutta, India. In 1989, an earthquake measuring 7.1 in magnitude killed 67 people and injured over 3,000 in San Francisco. The music group The Drifters topped the U.S. pop charts on October 17th, 1960 with Save the Last Dance for Me.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye to let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand beneath the pale moonlight.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame selected the Drifters for induction in 1988 alongside the Beatles, the Supremes, the Beach Boys, and Bob Dylan. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Oh, I know that the music's fine.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A recent spate of deadly bombings perpetrated by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, has killed scores of people in and around Baghdad. ISIL often sends suicide bombers into congested, predominantly Shiite neighborhoods in the capital. The United States strongly condemns this vicious string of suicide, vehicle-borne, and other attacks carried out by ISIL. Those slain include courageous Iraqi citizens from all walks of life, including Ahmed al-Kafaji, an elected member of parliament from Basra province, and Major General Ahmed Sadak al-Dulaimi, the police chief of Anbar province. The United States is committed to working with the government of Iraq and its coalition partners to end this terrorist scourge. The U.S. will continue to target ISIL leaders, fighters, supplies and weapons, facilities and safe havens, working in support of Iraqis as the U.S. works to restore the capacity of the Iraqi security forces to effectively counter ISIL on its own. ISIL, through these attacks, looks to tear apart the diverse fabric of Iraqi society, something it has sought to do over the past decade in its earlier incarnation, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Iraqi people have shown resilience in the face of this terror before, and with the world now united behind a global campaign to degrade and defeat ISIL, they will prevail once again. Over 60 coalition partners have committed themselves to the goals of eliminating the threat posed by ISIL and have already contributed in various capacities to the effort to combat ISIL in Iraq, the region, and beyond. The United States will continue to stand with all Iraqi citizens from all parts of the country as they work to root out violent extremists and promote the unified, federal, pluralistic, and democratic state envisioned in the Iraqi Constitution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.